It's Great Mondays Radio. I'm Josh Levine, your host, founder of Great Mondays. We help executives from hypergrowth technology and social enterprise organizations build cultures that attract, engage, and retain top talent. If you'd like to be a guest on our program, hang out for about 20 minutes and I'll tell you how. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Great Mondays Radio. I am super, super excited to have Tiffany McDowell. She is an organizational design strategist, an Ernst & Young as a partner. She's an author, consultant, and educator. And she is here to talk to us about the concept of people texture, her concept of people texture. She has a lot of experience in organizational design. And I just thought her ideas were really relevant and unique in kind of her approach. There's a lot of stuff going on out there, and I think Tiffany has done a lot of work and wanted to share her experience with us. Tiffany, thanks for coming on Great Mondays Radio.
Thanks, Josh. Happy to be here. Very excited.
All right. Fantastic. So Tiffany, you call yourself an organizational design strategist. Is that what you always wanted to be when you were a kid? Like, you saw that and you're like, I'm going to be an organizational design. So how did you get here? I'm just being cheeky. How did you get to become
sure. I'm not sure that's actually listed as a job title anywhere, but yes, I did not, as a small child, dream of this particular thing, although perhaps I came by it honestly. So my dissertation, when I was doing my doctorate, you know, I'd had fun jobs, not fun jobs. I've decided, okay, I need to figure out how to make work fun. And so I was studying what I thought were my two great hypotheses. One is that there's fun people like me. And then the other is that there's fun climates or cultures for fun. And so I, you know, set about my research, I did my work, and to my surprise, I found that there was a lot of support for a fun climate. So a fun, you know, creating context where people could have a good time was actually good for the soul as well as good for business outcomes. But there was no support for fun people. So like the individual difference, the personality difference didn't really predict anything of interest in the business context. You know, so it was really about creating the environment. And so I kind of went into consulting and sort of spent my life's work trying to figure out how do you create that right environment to make work more enjoyable, you know, better for everyone. And that's really how I sort of came to be this org design person.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And what, when you first started getting into like consulting, let me give you some context. I don't feel there is often, or there has not been in the future, there may be roles explicitly outlined for, in my case, culture, or in your case, organizational design. Was that a thing that you were like, yes, I'm going to go get hired right into this particular role, or did you start in a different way?
I started probably as most consultants do in the big consulting firm. So I came from industry, had my business background, found that to be a little dull, wasn't fun. So, you know, went back to school, went to consulting to do, because I wanted to have that excitement and that sort of, you know, changing and getting experiences all over different sectors, all over different topics. So came in as sort of a typical change management type of consultant, which I would say is probably a job posting somewhere.
Yes,
and,
definitely.
You know, they sort of say, go ahead and, you know, do some change management here. We're doing a big program. We're implementing a technology. We're changing the processes. We're doing something, you know, significant, and the people need to behave differently. And so for me, I, of course, believing that it was not really about a better communication to an individual to make them better individually. It was really about creating an environment that drove the behaviors you were looking for. Every change management problem to me was an org design problem, because I was like, well, you don't need to change the people. You just change the context and then you'll get a different behavior. Then you'll get a different outcome. So that to me, you know, was really how I just turned all of my, it just, that was the lens I saw everything through. And I was, you know, trial and error over the years, able to figure out which elements of the environment actually changed both the behavior and the business outcome.
Right. Okay. So your thesis is that for the most part, the people are, have the skills, they're the kinds of people that need to be there. And it's really the context that's going to allow for the business to do, to change or improve or do whatever they're trying to achieve. Is that right?
Exactly right. So one of the main reasons that I sort of set about developing a model was because I kept seeing that we would have these big group and social system problems, these organizational issues that we were trying to tackle. And so we'd say, well, maybe that person needs to go get some training, or, you know, they have some, you know, they could really work on their growth mindset, or they should be more curious as an individual. And I'm no doubt, right? I always say to people, I'm sure you can improve. Self-improvement is a great goal. Ask my husband. I'm always saying people can improve, you know, you know, there's lots of projects around here. But no, the reality is, at the end of the day, there's no relationship between individual difference variable and an organizational outcome. And so once you sort of realize that, you know, again, getting personal improvement and growth and opportunity is fantastic. And I'm 100% for it, but it's not relevant to like a macro enterprise business problem. You have to look at the social, the context, the group, and the system in order to get that outcome. So that's really, you know, what I had to figure out in order to be able to really then put a model together that could change.
Great. Okay. So in your book entitled Strategies for Organization Design, you use what you call the people texture model to improve collaboration and performance. So tell us, what is the people texture model, and describe how we got here.
Yeah, so it was definitely trial and error how we got here, and definitely a made up word that is a bit of a mouthful, but thank you for saying it. So it's really about architecting for people. So obviously organizations are just a collection of people, and it's some, you know, and so we do need to understand that we need to design for humans at center, but we don't need to design for individuals. We don't work by ourselves very often. We do heads down, tails up work, and that's very good and productive and important. But for the most part, you know, organizations basically like groups of people working together to get something greater than you could as an individual. So we need to design for humans in social contexts. And that's really what, to me, has been missing. We did human capital, we did individual, we do skills, we do, you know, train, you know, but really we've missed this whole spirit of the fact that it's not really about how you as an individual are, how smart you are, how great you are, you know, how good you were at school. It's about your position in the network and how your position in the network can drive efficiency or growth or innovation or new ideas. And so once you understand that, you need to design for that, right? And so for me, it took me a lot of years to really, really understand that. And then to look at all the different elements of the literature, look at all the different levers we can pull, and kind of come up with what I think is a predictive model, which is there's sort of six elements in people texture. One is structure. So we're not going to get away from sticks and boxes. Hierarchy is always going to be there. It's not a bad thing. It's great. It's efficient. It's productive. It's clear. You understand.
That's what I was going to say. It's clear. You can understand it, right? Like, that's
yeah. At a certain size, you need to get some sort of efficiencies and decision making and communication and sort of just being able to follow a chain of command like that. That at a certain size and groups just organically happen no matter what kind of system you look at. We're going to form hierarchy at a certain size. So part of it is that anyone who says, you know, forget bosses, there's no roles, I haven't seen it myself. Maybe in small startups, of course, you can wear multiple hats till you get to about 20 or 30 people, and then it starts to break down. So there's nothing wrong with hierarchy. It's good. Design the best one you can. Try not to sort of break it and mess with it too much with too many dotted lines and all the sort of complex things people do. But then that's about 20% of how organizations work. So that's part of my model, but not all of it. So the other part is really, the other 80% is really these sort of creating these connections, these horizontal connections, and intentionally designing the network. So first being able to see it and measure it through some of the tools and data that we now have available to us in companies, and then actually influencing it intentionally. How do you do that? You do it through, you know, clarity and just some of the traditional things. How do you make decisions? How are you going to make decisions together? Who gets to make what decision? Who doesn't get to make what decision? What are your roles? How does everyone understand what everyone else is doing, what they're accountable for? And then are you actually putting the right metrics, incentives, rewards in place that go with those decision accountabilities and go with those clarity of roles to actually drive the behaviors you want to get that teaming. So those are all the different elements of people texture that together in concert give you the outcomes you're looking for from both a experience as well as a business performance.
All right. Can I ask you to go through them just one at a time? Say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Because I wrote down a bunch of things, but I wasn't sure which was a specific item. So just for clarity, people texture are 6 things.
So the 6 things, the first one is structure. So structure being, again, that horizontal, the vertical, you know, sticks and boxes, as well as that horizontal sort of what I call traces of trust in an organization. So that's the first one. So it's both vertical and horizontal structure. Then the next one is really around responsibility. So where's that, you know, clarity of ownership, that empowerment where you can in traditional hierarchies, you can give someone authority, but only you as an individual can decide if you're going to take responsibility for something, right? So it's a different between how do you have that really nicely clean functioning hierarchy and how do you then put things in place in the network to allow people to take that responsibility and that agency for that.
I like that. Take responsibility. Okay. Got it.
So structure, responsibility, governance, which is kind of your, how do you make decisions in the network? So how do you make collective decisions and how clear is that? How empowering is that, et cetera? That's a big part of the work that I do is forget sticks and boxes. Like, how do you make decisions together, and how do you break ties, right? And when there's friction, because there's always friction, which is fine. That's by design. But then, how do you resolve it? And then that sort of on the other side of that structurally is the roles, right? So, what are the roles? You know, are the roles and the scope of the role understood both within that person's, do they get that, but also between, right? Do we understand what each other is doing and what positions we're playing, you know, in the organization?
Yeah. So that's number four.
That's number four. And then you have measurement, which I love this one because it's always been in, you know, back in any org model, you've had something to do with like, how do you reward people, right? Yes, but what's really been missing in my experience is the connection, sort of how we make these big business unit P&L, where are we going to place top P&L responsibility for the organization through to then how do we then sort of cascade that into our different functional areas? How do we resolve the friction that's caused when we have two groups with, you know, competing metrics, right? Yeah. And then how do we just then translate that into team goals and individual incentives and rewards? Like, what are those levels of connection from top and like top enterprise decision making into individual rewards? We tend to have different parts of the organization doing those things, different decision makers coming up with one and another, and like never the two shall meet. So for me, it's that connection. So that's a measurement component, which covers all of that. And in my book, I talk about Dan Pink, who says that great line, what science knows and what business does, right? Like they're completely unrelated. We know we can't put riders on knowledge work and get better performance, but we do it all the time, right? I mean, every day we design that. So it's truly trying to get the understanding of that and then fix it, sort of fixing that to be able to make the whole system work. And then finally, it's that sort of teaming, which I think has been really interesting lately in this hybrid work environment. What are those inflection points where you really need to have shared mental models? How do you bring people together to get that, so you really truly get that teaming? And so we talk a lot about extreme teaming and some of the other teaming literature to really drive those horizontal behaviors.
All right. I want to dig in on a couple of things. Thank you for outlining that. So let's just start with, let's go in reverse. So teaming, what's the most common successful mental model that hybrid organizations are starting to, are emerging from hybrid organizations when it comes to teaming?
So in my experience, as well as what I really have been studying in the literature, because I think it's a fascinating topic, is that we know there are inflection points where people need proximity. So proximity accelerates trust. Proximity allows you to get faster, you know, sort of sharing of a mental model. In fact, just today I was looking at the literature on network, on loose ties and the network relationships.
Yes.
And what they showed, I think it was Arena and one of the founders of Workalytics, but they were showing that if you get people together 3 to 4 times a year, if you are being mostly hybrid, you can see that the formation of relationships in that, let's say, a couple day offsite, right? You get the effects of those loose ties. You keep them for about 3 months and then they dissipate. So if you use that data to then drive to how often do we come together for these big offsites where we create that energy, we create that social connection intentionally, right? We drive those things, and then we get the benefits organizationally for a couple, you know, 2-3 months, and then we do it again. Mm. So that, I think, just looking at that data is really important to tell us. And so I, you know, proximity for reasons, not proximity because you should come in on Tuesdays and Thursdays and sit in your office and do Zoom, as everyone's complained about for 2 years.
I feel like that comes up comes up on almost every other episode that I'm recording. I think everybody's like, finally, like, oh my God, you guys, right? Sorry.
And you know, to me, like, so what I've been trying to bring, and I'm not a network scientist, I'm an IO psychologist, but to me, I've been trying to bring these fields together for a long time. This use case of return to work or return to hybrid or hybrid, whatever you want to call it, is at least giving us a really strong, powerful set of, you know, insights from the data that we have, that all organizations have, about how are our patterns of you know, communication and relationships, how have they changed over time because of the way that we've changed our work environment. And we're showing with data that, you know, if you do it intentionally, you can make hybrid effective. But fully remote, we're also demonstrating through data, is not effective, especially at the individual. You're sacrificing, you know, your pay, your performance, your career, your promotion, if you do not sort of participate in a hybrid environment. So anyway, but that's one part of the, I guess, one part of the answer. And then the other part would be some of the teaming stuff that we've always known that continues to be true, which is there's no one right way to run a team. The thing that we've proven out, and I think Project Aristotle, the Google, you know, biggest teaming study ever, the most data ever proved out. I don't think there's anything more compelling yet in the literature that I'm aware of. That's, it doesn't matter what your norms are, as long as you all agree to the norms and adhere to them. So if you think your team should come every Monday for 5 minutes and huddle, great. If you think you should meet on Mondays for 3 hours and then go off and do things and come, great. If you think you should, you know, whatever it is you think and you agree and you norm around and you stick to it, that's what gives that that higher trust, psychological safety, and overall better team performance over time.
Mm-hmm. Are you able to share the article that you referred to, with the 3 months, 3 to 4 months, is that something that's publicly available?
Yeah, no, I was literally just reading it on LinkedIn this morning. There's a, yes, I can
send it to
we
me.
Can
we'll
get
put
that
in,
in
we'll put
link.
In the, yeah. The episode yeah. show notes. I think that's really
yes.
One, I'm going to read it, so that's awesome. And then I am trying very hard to get the CEO of a fully distributed organization on the pod. So once we get that, we'll announce it. And his model has been twice a year. So I'm excited to hear him. He's sort of like, this is where what works for us, come together twice a year. And there's a global organization. So I love that. And I love that. I think that's really interesting. I agree. There's a lot that we can do remotely to build that trust, but it is really hard to replace that. You can't replace that in-person experience. And I like that phrase, proximity accelerates trust. That's really good. Okay, the other, I'm very interested in each of these. There's two more that I want to get into a little bit more. One is, and I think it's more of a, just to underscore it, this idea of roles. And what, to me, what you said was not just what I understand what my role is, do my peers and my colleagues understand what my role is. Can you talk a little bit about why that's important and maybe flesh that out a little bit?
So one of the things that I find that my clients have spent lots of time and money over the many years working with us as consultants to really clarify like decision rights, roles, accountability, you know. And so you refine these things, you spend a lot of time getting very specific, it gives people some level of comfort and clarity. But what tends to happen, you might know this, you don't really get up in the morning and go, okay, now what did that role profile say that I was supposed to do today? Because I should read it before I start my day, right?
Right.
So we don't even know what's in our own. We can get as specific as you want in your job descriptions, your success profiles. And that's kind of like, there's nothing wrong with it, but it's not really something that guides our behavior. And so what tends to happen is we kind of know what we do, but then we don't really know what the other person does. And so then we go, well, I should probably make that decision because I'm doing this. And so then they think, well, I should probably make that decision. So what's more relevant than reading the job description to know what you do is to actually understand where your accountability sort of starts and ends and where there's shared accountability. And in some of the more advanced organizations, we've seen, and there's some really cool tools, and I have some in the book at the end that people can pick up and use, but where you start to do role crafting, which is a technique that came out of academia, which is really about how do I then work with my peers, my colleagues, my team, whatever, to actually start to say, well, gee, I really like doing a lot of this and you really like doing a lot of that. What if I did a little more of this and you did a little more of that, and we could sort of move some stuff around, and really getting that clarity, but also that camaraderie around, like, you know, maybe switch some tasks around, you know, some people. So getting, so roles and having a line of sight into like what you're supposed to do, what do you like to do, and all back to your strengths and all the good stuff that's been done in that space really kind of brings that all together to get to that level of understanding what position you're playing on the team and what other positions other people are playing. Because if you think about a team, like, that's really what you need, right?
I love this. It's like at once it's one of those like inevitable obvious things, and also I feel like such an idiot for not having, you know, seen it right up front, but I feel like that's, you know, that's sort of one of these amazing, like, that's the quintessential symptoms of like an amazing kind of insight. And what I'm drawing here, what's really interesting about what you're describing is the people on the team are co-developing their roles. They're organic and they're evolving, instead of, oh, here's the thing where you're hired for XYZ, that's defined by clearly input maybe from the team manager or whatever the last person did, but it doesn't necessarily leave room for organic growth and strengths and weaknesses. And you're like, who does what? But this sort of co-development, it's almost like you're in agreement around that. And that to me feels like a whole nother level to a job description, a role that we just haven't even touched on, where it's like forming, norming, storming, you know, that type of thing. It's like, you need to have that too for your role. You need to be able to be like, all right, this is generally the area I'm going to work in, and then I'm going to come in, and then I'm going to like we do it anyways. Your role is going to change and evolve anyways, and you're like, let's be more explicit about that. So that's amazing. I've locked that in. That's good. I like that one a lot. That's a really interesting insight. Okay, the other one that I want more clarity on, because this has come up with some of my clients recently, and I just want to know more about this idea, the governance piece and the collective decision making. And no matter how I approach it, like, I feel like this organizations just can't get this right, and I don't know why. What are some of the challenges that you've observed? And if we're lucky, maybe you have some solutions too, but I don't want to put that out there as a promise yet. But why is it more likely that an organization is just not great at collective decision making?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm sure we could spend quite a bit of time trying to come up with the right answer here. There's a series of, I would say challenges, right, with collective decision making. One of which is just foundationally, individually, we are poor at decision making. We have, 137 natural biases built in order to sort of survive, and evolutionary psychology would tell you why. And I've written about that, and a lot of others have too. It's super interesting. But fast forward to actually be working in a group and working in where there's varying degrees of decision that need to be made. And, I go and ask people, well, how many of you have ever been in a meeting where all the decision makers that were needed weren't there? Hands up. I mean, 100%. How many of you have ever been in a meeting and you're talking about a decision you thought you already made? Hands up,
I'm putting both my arms up for that. Yes. All right.
How
You're like,
many hands can I
didn't
have
we
here?
already have this meeting last month or whatever?
So it's literally, it's intuitively everyone knows we're terrible. And so, I think so why so there's one of the things I find interesting, it kind of goes back to my original hypothesis, which is we have these group and system level issues, and we try to solve them with individual difference solutions. So I had an old client, senior leader, big CEO. We're doing a lot of really difficult change that, leadership alignment work around a big change that was happening for their enterprise. Decisions were shifting and leaders were shifting. And I asked the CEO, how do you, when this friction comes up, because friction's going to come up, you have two different businesses, you're sort of got competing priorities, we've designed it that way, it's natural. How do you think it's best to resolve this? Well, I'll just call the guy up and chat. He seems reasonable. I'm like, yeah, no, I'm sure he is reasonable. I'm sure you're all very reasonable people. But that is not a solution to it. The problem is not an individual difference problem. The problem is friction in two big businesses that are, intentionally competing for things. You need a formal group and system level mechanism for the solution. And if you don't sort of, if you don't kind of allow that to take place, you end up with a lot of, fighting and hurt feelings and decision, reinventing decisions, not making decisions,
Not making
the passive
decisions.
aggressive organization. Remember that article? So at a very high level, the solution is to mostly allow decisions not to be in governance. Like if I tell my clients, like, stop creating governing bodies, you got to have some, but like if you can just make a decision and you have the authority in the hierarchy or the accountability in the network of team you've created, the trust, then please make that decision and don't create a whole bunch of extra bureaucracy and overhead in order to have that forum. But for the places that you just can't, you cannot make that decision in that particular vertical, you don't have that small, agile kind of team that can make the decision and go, they don't have the decision authority to do it. You do need a formal mechanism, and how you do it, you can make it as least, as agile as possible. But you need a place to be able to take those natural friction points and actually drive accountability around the decision and the decision outcome. Because what we also know is that we can make decisions, but we don't cascade them properly to everybody else. So nobody, well, I made the decision, I'm good. Well, nobody else knows about so
What is
they're still remaking the
the
decision
decision,
and
the implications of the decision? So we need to document that. So we need to literally sign on the line. They're like, hey, everybody, we're all making this choice, and here's the impl here's right. Like it is to me. I almost had a traumatic re response to your point about the passive aggressive. We don't make decisions. It's and it's like I guess there's a bunch of different ways, and I don't know if you can list off just maybe are there a few examples? Just give me a little hors d'oeuvre platter of how do we document, identify, or document, or determine that we've made a decision? Like, what are the levers? What can we put in place?
I think it depends on which sort of slice you're taking of the organization, how formal you want to be. But I think overall, kind of where you're going with this is transparency, right? I mean, we can all these tools now that we have available, where the meeting notes get documented, and any decisions get made, and that you can read it, right? I mean, that's great. I mean, as we start to get more adoption of those types of things, and we allow our data to be transparent, which I think we should, I think the risk of not knowing what the decision was is much greater organization than the risk of having people read the minutes,
Especially in a
right?
hybrid
So,
workspace, you need to make that
yeah. And
documentation.
so it is the discipline. It's so simple and mechanic. It's just not that exciting. It's not that sexy. But we've literally done consulting projects where part of it is, here's the template for the meeting agenda. Here's the meeting minute. Here's the communication. Here's who's accountable for sending the communication out about the decisions that were made, which stakeholder groups are getting them, how they then are accountable for communicating those decisions. Like, very simple things that are not really, but and they're not new, but they're just, and there is literature. It's been around for a long time. There's different studies that have shown, when they look back, they do a longitudinal study of decisions made in an organization, that the deep analysis, great financials, like all those things are not bad. Again, great, go ahead, no problem. But decision process outperforms that type of decision analysis by 6 times. So you can get 6x performance uptick in your decision, of your business decision, just by following a decision process. So, which, how, I mean, that all that is the mechanics we just talked about. And I mean, there's no law and there's no downside to that, right?
No. Yeah.
There's
I
only
mean
upside.
it almost proves the kind of the maxim, right, where it's like any decision is better than no decision, right? Even if it's the wrong decision, like at least you're making some choices. And I feel like that's there's a decision paralysis around, right? The analysis paralysis. It's like, well, I don't know if it's, do we have enough information? Do we? And I'm not saying you should just go on. We talked about 127 whatever biases and like, hey, I just think we should go this direction. Okay, fine. Maybe sometimes. And you should have that data. But the point is, decisions, we swing too hard in the not making decision direction. And on top of that, even if we have made a decision, we haven't gone thoroughly through it and actually cascaded that down and really documented it and made sure everybody understands that. Did I get that
Yeah,
right? Is that
that's
correct?
yeah, and just doing that gives you a huge uptick in the effectiveness of the decisions you make, regardless of whether or not they were the perfect decision, just following a decision process. And that kind of goes to the and decision making in groups is better than decision making as an individual, because you tend, sort of the wisdom of crowd type of concept. Now, there's also the madness of crowd concept. So let's not, it's not a perfect formula. It's not just groups don't just make better decisions. In fact, they can make far worse decisions with certain biases getting, amplified. But if you do certain things, to address our biases within groups, you get actually a better decision outcome, and then you make it transparent. I mean, you're just really, business-wise, upping your business performance without really investing anything except, just transparency and process, which, I mean, there's no downside.
Amazing. That's great. Thank you so much. There's so much more that I feel like I could ask, but we are coming up at the end of our time. Strategies for Organization Design is your book. You can find it at organizationalstrategist.com is the website where you can find out more about Tiffany McDowell. Tiffany, any final insights or parting words, either just from your experience or from the book that you would like to share, takeaways maybe?
I think for me, and my life's work has been trying to, I have to go to work every day, so I want it to be more fun and enjoyable. And for me, like, just realizing and acknowledging that if you do intentionally design these components of an organization's context, you can actually get to that unleashing the humanness of work and actually allowing it to be more fun and enjoyable. And so for me, if people could take away that taking these elements in concert and understanding how they work together and using that to, for good, to make the world a better working, better working world, then to me, that would be a great outcome. So yes, thank you. I love it too.
The organ is the structure will set you free. Is what
there
I hear.
You go.
Well,
love
I do
that.
Love any book that that suggests six key components for organizing an organization. So thank you so much. I appreciate it, Tiffany McDowell. I appreciate you coming on Great Mondays Radio.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you. Pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Great Mondays Radio. Hey, if you want to be a guest, head over to radio.greatmondays.com. And if you think this episode was interesting and your friends and fans would enjoy it, please share on social media. And if you want to get more people to understand the power of company culture in business today, please rate and review Great Mondays Radio on your podcast feed. It really helps us reach more people. If you want to hear more candid conversations with culture leaders, subscribe to Great Mondays Radio. I'd love to connect with you. Find me on LinkedIn at AKA Josh Levine, on YouTube at Great Mondays, and you can always email me, josh@greatmondays.com. Find out more about our work with hypergrowth technology and social enterprise organizations at greatmondays.com. I'm Josh Levine. Thanks for listening to Great Mondays Radio.